The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm very excited to be here to introduce tonight's guest, David Zucker. David Zucker, along with Jim Abrams and Jerry Zucker, are the auteurs of the cultishly adored Kentucky Fried Movie and Top Secret. Each of these giants of comedy have branched out into other beloved films and film series. Tonight's author himself went on to direct a plethora of other films, including my beloved Naked Gun franchise, Basketball, Scary Movie 3 and 4, and many others, as well as writing and producing Scary Movie 5. He is also the author of the memoir Before the Invention of Smiling, an unconventional telling of his family history. He, of course, joins us tonight with Surely You Can't Be Serious, The True Story of Airplane. It's a behind-the-scenes making-of oral history of the 1980 titular comedy classic as told by its equally legendary writers and directors, again, the Zuckers and Jim Abrams. Featuring anecdotes by the film's stars, it also delves into the making of fan-favorite scenes and the organic red pre-internet evolution toward its place in the pop culture pantheon. So as both a lover of books and a lover of this film, I wonder what to make of it. And I suppose I can make a hat or a brooch or a pterodactyl. Tonight's author will be in conversation with James Murray. You may also know him as Murr, one of the hosts of the long-running and popular True TV improv program, Impractical Jokers. Also the co-author of the Awakened and Area 51 Intern series of sci-fi novels, he has toured solo as a stand-up comedian, starred in TBS's The Misery Index, and appeared in numerous other television shows and films. Speaking of his comedy tour, you can catch him this Thursday, the 26th, at the Starland Ballroom in nearby Sayersville, New Jersey. And now to David and Murr, I think I speak for everyone in Philadelphia when I say, I just want to tell you both, good luck. We're all counting on you. Please welcome tonight's guests.
Okay, you can have it.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Welcome. Hi,
do
Dave.
I get this, so
I hold.
Can I just, you hold it?
Yeah, yo, you do what you want.
How about now? Can they even hear
They're
me?
Freaking out. I was supposed to sit in that chair. They have the spotlights aimed toward my bald head.
That's how you should be seen.
Yeah. How about a hand for David Zucker, everybody? Holy cow.
And James Murray.
Oh, thank you.
It's
thank
an honor
you.
For me. Not really, but
I was honored when David asked me to be part of tonight. He had first called Sal, but he was on his solo tour. And then he called Joe, but Joe was with his dogs.
Yeah.
And Q was with his cats. But I was the fourth call he made, and I said yes.
You should be happy with that.
You're congratulations, my friend.
10.
I have read
thank
the book
you.
Entirely. Has anyone read the book yet? Not yet.
Well, they're in for a
here?
Treat. Yes.
Go home and read the book.
Yeah.
The book is amazing. It's incredible. It's incredible insights into Airplane, how it was made. I found it as insightful as to your process of growing up, how you guys developed your comedy from all the way from Wisconsin to LA, then ultimate success with Airplane in your career since. You know, we on Impractical Jokers, we've made so many references to Airplane, Naked Gun, all of the Zucker Brothers movies over the years. And one of the proudest moments of my life was when you came on Impractical Jokers and told me I wasn't funny.
That's right. Yeah. I remember that now, yes. Yeah.
But it's, you know, your comedic idol telling you you're not funny is gold. It's perfect.
But I was also on the one where it was the Joker's dinner.
You were on Dinner Party as a guest.
I that one, too, right?
That's right.
Okay.
And again, ripped into me.
I don't know why. I don't like you that much.
You know, I can sense
but
it.
But I'm glad to have you here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
If it helps sell the book, this is great. But actually, wait a minute. I have to say, I'm a huge admirer of the Jokers, and I think they're the funniest thing out there. And I think they're about the only thing that really makes me laugh.
Okay, so I thought I'd start by telling a quick story of how the Zucker Brothers and us met. We've idolized you for decades, literally our formative comedy growing up, for sure. Even more so than Mel Brooks or other greats out there, was our style of comedy was definitely Airplane style of comedy. And years ago, we were at the Wild West Comedy Festival, the guys and I.
In Nashville,
yeah. That's right. And I saw, we were at breakfast in the morning, and I saw Zucker and his brother sitting across from us. And I said, holy shit, do you know who that is? That's the Zucker Brothers. I lost my mind. I told the guys. We went over. They blew us off. They they asked us to bust their table, which is strange.
Well, we didn't know who you were. But
you didn't know the show yet.
I didn't know the show. I think I had walked in one time to the Den, and Charles was watching it. And I remember that from years, but I didn't pay much attention. I was only there for 3 minutes, and I left.
Yeah, so his son was a fan of the show and had seen the show before, so we asked if we could send you some DVDs of the show, and we did, and not expecting a response.
Well, I didn't watch it for a month.
Yeah.
And then I finally watched it, and do you want me to tell the story?
Sure,
I was laughing so hard, I could only watch 20 minutes of it because I was literally choking.
Which is great, because the episodes are only 22 minutes long, by the way.
Somehow I lasted for 20 minutes, though. I couldn't see the rest of the 2 minutes.
So anyways, like a month or two after we sent him the DVDs, an email comes in from David Zucker to our emails. I remember it distinctly. It was Saturday night. It was like a midnight. The email comes in from him telling us that he couldn't watch the show for more than like 20 minutes at a time because he had tears of laughter streaming down his face. And the guys and I immediately got on a group conference call screaming like children at how excited we were. And to this day, in my house, is that email framed, autographed by you. Isn't that wild?
Yeah. And I'll autograph a book, too.
Yeah. But anyways, tonight is about Airplane and its legacy and how important of a movie it was in history and culture. In comedy, of course, as you affected so many comedians throughout the years. I thought it'd be great to start with you just telling us about what it was like growing up in Wisconsin, being the funniest guys there.
Well, we weren't the funniest guys there.
No, really, that weren't. Was obvious, yeah.
But yeah, and we say that in the book. I mean, there were probably five or six guys in our high school who we thought were funnier than we were, but they were able to find jobs after school. And we just started this theater and got into comedy. But there was something in the water, I suppose. There was one story we tell in the book about we had this room at the top of the third floor of the high school, which is called the Copper Dome. It was a glass ceiling, and the acoustics were very bad. So what the school did, they put a huge American flag across the ceiling, and it really solved the acoustic problem. And so Jim Abrams had a class there, and one day they had a substitute teacher. And the substitute teacher says, well, how do you usually start the day? And Jim's friend Pete Prusing said, well, we always say Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. And so he lays down on his back and looks up, and the whole class did the same, and the teacher did the same too. And they said the Pledge of Allegiance. So this was what went on at Shorewood High School.
And tell us about college. What was your first experience making a movie like in college?
Well, I think when I was a junior, I took this course called Introduction to Radio, Television, Film, taught by a professor named Chuck Sherman. And I thought, oh my God, this is great. I could actually take a class in what I want to do. And so one of the assignments was to do a short film. So I did a 10-minute short film, and it was a comedy film, of course.
So I'm sure your other students in the class did all sorts of serious art.
It was
films.
Total like light reflected through under tables and very esoteric artsy stuff. And my movie was about my brother Jerry running around the campus, being chased by a guy with his pants down, and he was trying to find a place to pee. And finally, I guess it's funny, but he gets up on the top of Lincoln statue and pees. But that was it, the 6-7 minute film. So I show it in my study section for about 20 students, and as I said, they all did very, you know, very serious things. And then my movie comes on, and everybody laughed, maybe despite themselves. But and so the TA said, "Well, you just have to enter that in a film festival." So a week later, he says, "You know, he showed the movie to the professor, and said Professor Sherman wants to show it in the big lecture class, you know, 600 students." So Jerry and I went there and actually showed it in front. It's like, it was like a movie theater. It was our first experience showing a movie, and it was laughs, a lot of laughs. It was great. I think we were hooked after that.
We
thought, hey, we could do movies. Yeah.
All right. And then, but your first move wasn't into movies. You started, of course, the Kentucky Fried Theater, first in Wisconsin, then ultimately in LA.
Yeah, you can't go right to Hollywood and apply for a job as a movie director. So what we did, we started a little theater called Kentucky Fried Theater, and we had 70 seats in the back of a bookstore, and it was very popular. And so we could only charge $1 admission, so we decided, well, we have to move to either New York or L.A. And by that time, the Tonight Show had moved to California, to L.A., so we decided we'd try to do that so we can get on the Tonight Show, and it would probably be more comfortable to starve in the warm weather of L.A. as opposed to New York.
What was the experience like running your own theater for so many years?
Well, it got to be a place to experiment with our humor, and so we did this theater in Madison and for a year, and then 5 years in L.A. It was twice as big of an audience, and we got to experiment with humor, see what worked, you know, with a live audience every night, and that was like invaluable to us.
Were you changing the show on a daily basis based on audience reactions?
No, we were much too lazy to ever do that. We did one show, and we did some improvisations, but then the guy who was with us who did improvisations quit, and then we didn't do any improvisations. And but it was we would sometimes ad lib, but what we would do then is and the ad libs got big laughs, and so we would keep the ad lib line in the show, but as an ad lib, and we'd all pretend that it was the first time we heard it, and we'd all laugh, and we were so full of shit. It was like, it was unbelievable. Yeah.
In L.A., the theater exploded. It did very, very well for a number of years.
It did. Yeah. It was. We were packed. Well, we had no ad budget. We just came from Wisconsin, not really any money, and so we called our first show My Nose, just so our weekly L.A. Times listing would say, "My Nose runs continuously." So it was like, we did better jokes later. But we rented a big billboard out right outside the theater in the vacant lot, and we said, "This is it, Kentucky Fried Theater." We rented it for a month, and then we organized a protest against a neighborhood protest. 100 people showed up, and we called the media, LA Times, TV stations, and they were told that a big corporation planned to tear down the billboard and plant a tree in its place. And we were carrying placards saying, "Save the sign." And we were packed after that. It was like,
that's brilliant. Yeah, my favorite story you've ever told is, you know, I'm sure you're all wondering what did they do with the airplane money when they made all that money, right? And one of the things you did was you bought a racehorse.
Oh, that's right. A racehorse, yeah.
But the racehorse was solely for a joke.
Well, it was solely for a joke. And we had to buy 3 racehorses because we had to name the horse. So you have to put a mare in foal, and it takes 3 years. We named the horse All Pink. And we told the jockey, don't bother trying to win the race. Just run the horse on the rail. So we get the call from the track announcer, and it's All Pink on the inside. And so,
can you believe it?
What do you know? The
coming up, it's All Pink on the inside.
Yeah. So the first horse didn't get the call. So we had to put another mare in foal, another 3 years. And another $30,000 or something, you know, and that was called Old Pink, and the third one was AWL All Pink. That got the call.
Yeah. All Pink on the inside.
Yeah,
that's a $100,000 joke right there. I love that. Yeah. Which is actually your commitment to the joke is one of the things we admire most about you. I mean, there's so many great stories of how committed you get to the joke. My favorite is Watambi Metapupu. What is his name? The from your high school reunion.
Oh
days.
Yeah,
Watambi is it?
This was no. It was we had mostly all white high school, but the only black person was the exchange student Mujabi Mapaka. And everybody loved him, and of course we all called him Blowjobby, and he thought it was funny. Anyways, so 40 years pass, and then at our reunion, my friend Louis Friedman and I hired an actor from Milwaukee to come to the reunion in an African dashiki and claim that he was Mujabi, and so
Well, the joke goes further. So they hired this black actor to come into their 40-year high school reunion pretending he was the Kenyan student, transfer student from 40 years earlier.
We dressed him in the dashiki, which the real Mujabi never wore. And he goes, and we gave him a speech to read. Mm-hmm. And he said, "In my country, there is no homosexuality. I had to learn what I had to. I would be put to death for things that I did with some of you in high school, and you know, and just stuff like that. And the guy, the actor, was great. And then everybody wanted to have their picture taken with him.
Sure.
And then they sent it to the guy who is his AFS family, you know, guy. And the guy said, "That's not Mujabi." And so then they called the FBI. They thought this was an African prince, and they were going to, yeah.
The joke goes further. Yeah, Zucker did not stop this, there. Yeah.
Then we wrote an email on behalf of Mujabi to the guy in the class who was the most broke guy in the class, asking for $5,000 to return to Uganda, and then the whole class, the emails were just going all over the place, and then we made a fake news story that this guy named Arlen Smith was arrested in Joliet, Illinois for impersonating a person in the class and meaning to debunk them or defraud them out of money. And he said, we said in the article, he went over, he went under many pseudonyms like Mujabi Mapaka, Arando Makaba, Musaba Lababa, and Lars Jorgensen. We said in the article, I'm trying to remember all this, but we said in the article, he would often show up at reunions pick out one of the elderly people and romance them and have sex with them and debunk them out of. And it actually happened at one reunion. And so one of my classmates says, "We are not elderly." Yeah, that was her reaction. Anyway, so we kept doing it, and so. To this day, nobody found out. We never said anything.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
So he printed a fake news article, got sent around the email list of this black scam artist is going around pretending he's transfer students from people's high school reunions, seducing elderly white women and stealing them from out of $5,000.
But I want to cast the guy in a movie.
Yeah.
And then I'll put him, such and such played by Mujabi Mapaka. And then, so I can, if I'm on talk shows, I can actually tell the whole story.
I love this story. Yeah. I don't want to out you because story's too good. All these poor classmates of yours think it's
real. Yeah, but I had a great time on one of the cruises. I told the whole story and put up the news article on the screen and everything. It was fun.
So you moved to
L.A. Oh, yeah, book. Yes.
Yeah, the back of the book. Yes. The move to L.A. and then starting the Kentucky Fried Theater from scratch, literally rebuilding the theater. You had so many choices. You could have gone to New York. You could have gone to L.A. And God knows how different life would have been had you moved to New York or not gone to L.A. to start the Kentucky Fried Theater.
I think we really didn't know it at the time. We thought we were a performing group. And we didn't know. We really didn't think in our wildest dreams that we would, be movie directors or do movies until we actually were on The Tonight Show. And that was our dream. But we were kind of underwhelming on the Tonight Show. And so, and then we did a couple of other television appearances, national TV appearances. And I always say we made a joint decision with the networks not to do any more TV. So, but then we cast ourselves out of the show. We did another show and cast other actors so that we could concentrate on writing a movie.
One of the fascinating things I found in the book was the story that you would pitch. You know, Kentucky Fried Theater was basically a sketch variety show,
right.
Musical components to it, which sounds an awful lot like Saturday Night Live, right? This is before Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And you actually pitched a version of that, and the studios didn't want it.
No, we pitched it to our agent. Uh-huh. So we think a national show with music and comedy sketches and blah, blah, blah would work. And she said, no, that wouldn't work. But it was our fault for listening to this agent.
Sure. And then a few months later, a very young Lorne Michaels saw your show.
Yeah, and evidently we found out later, I read this in their book about Saturday Night Live, that he pitched Saturday Night Live to the network as a show based on Kentucky Fried Theater.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
I read it in the book, and my mind was blown that you inspired Saturday Night Live.
Evidently. But you know, we could not have done it. And, you know, Lorne is a brilliant producer. And he's the guy that should have done that show. And
yeah.
we really wanted to do movies. And
yeah.
so we wanted to do a movie, but we didn't have an idea for a movie.
Until you saw Zero Hour.
We would videotape overnight the, you know, late night television, hoping to get commercials to spoof in our show. And so one morning we cleared off the machine and we started getting involved, not in the commercials, but in the movie, the late night movie that was playing, which was this black and white movie called Zero Hour, had the exact same plot.
Some of the same dialogue.
There's a line in Zero Hour. It's the same thing. The guy with PTSD flies up in the plane and is chasing his girlfriend and food poisoning, and he has to fly down the plane. Same thing. So there's a line in Zero Hour that says, "Stewardess, we have to find somebody back there who not only can fly this plane, but who didn't have fish for dinner."
That's great.
And that was actually in the...
Another fascinating realization from reading the book was it was borderline just stealing direct lines from the movie.
Which really
pushes the limits of parody law when you're using exact dialogue.
Right, and we showed the script to John Landis, who we had met. And he said, "Guys, this isn't parody, this is plagiarism." And so we actually went and bought the rights,
which is wild. They bought the rights to Zero Hour,
which was cheap. They didn't see any value in it.
Sure, it had been many years earlier.
It was 1957. Yeah.
So they bought the rights to the movie, so there'd be no legal issues with directly parodying it.
Yeah, but Zero Hour had a lot of these setup lines that we used, like the guy who plays the air controller in Zero Hour says, "Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking." And that's right in Zero Hour. So we added quit drinking, amphetamines, and finally sniffing glue. Yeah. And the pilot, there's a little boy who comes up to the cockpit, and the pilot in Zero Hour gives a boy a little plane and says, "Have you ever been up on a plane before?" But that's all he said. We added all the other stuff. Yeah.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
Right, yeah. That led to,
Which is such an edgy line.
Yeah.
When you think, I cannot believe you got Peter Graves to say that.
Well,
of all people.
Peter Graves, when we first gave him the script, he reported later that he just threw the script across the room and said, "This is the worst piece of trash I've ever read." But our executive producer, Howard Koch, knew Peter, and so he had him to meet. And I think he was surprised. He expected that we were these drugged-out weirdos to have written a line like that. But, you know, we kind of impressed him as these just Midwestern guys.
That was interesting in the book, too, seeing how many hidden secret allies you had along the way,
such as
Howard Koch.
Very lucky. We were lucky just to get to Paramount. Every studio had turned it down. There was one guy, Michael Eisner, who was the head of Paramount, who heard about the script and just immediately called his second in command or the vice president there and said, he hadn't even read it. And he said, have those guys in my office on Monday. So, and he says in the book, he's interviewed, and he said, you know, he doesn't believe in waiting on anything. It's just act on it right away.
He's one of those angel, secret angels that, you know, unknown to anyone else, basically green lights your entire career.
Right. And I went to his office, made sure I went to his office in Century City in L.A. and personally gave him the book signed by the three of us. And I just wanted to thank him because I never thought we showed enough gratitude because we just didn't know at that time how much Michael Eisner did for us.
When you were selling the movie, the whole process of making the movie is fascinating in the book, too. It took years to get the movie off the ground. You had the script for upwards of 5 years
before
it was finally greenlit, right?
Yeah. Well,
even when it was at approach, you were in rewrites with the studio, with Paramount. But even then, you were holding off on selling them in the movie because they wouldn't let you be directors of the movie.
Right. Nobody wanted to let us direct because not only were we first-time directors, but there were three of us. And that had never been done. So finally, Paramount relented, and they said two provisos. Howard Koch would be our executive producer. He was a past president of the studio and president of the Motion Picture Academy. So this guy was high up there. And the other clause was that they could fire us after 2 weeks.
Which is crazy.
And you know, we were fine with being fired after 2 weeks. We didn't know who Howard Koch was, but he turned out to be, you know, our man at Paramount.
The go-between between your production and the studio that knew the studio business and how to get what you wanted, right?
Yeah, because when every weird suggestion came down from the studio, like they wanted to put in the role of Stryker, Bob Hayes, they wanted to put Barry Manilow. So,
can you imagine?
And we were just, you were these young cubs, and oh, we're going to quit, we're going to walk. And Howard said, just calm down, this'll go away. And some of the other executives who kind of befriended us and took us under their wing would call up, and they also wanted, you know, Bill Murray or Chevy Chase, and we didn't want comedians. And so they would call their agent and said, your client really doesn't want to do this. This is, you know, it's like their first-time directors. There are three of them. This is going to be chaos. And so we avoided that.
One of the fascinating things I learned, I didn't realize that Bruce Jenner auditioned for Airplane.
Right.
Isn't that wild?
He came. Somebody was pushing Bruce Jenner to be in the movie. I don't know who, but he came in three times to audition. And one time he went over to Jerry's apartment to run lines.
Really?
And he kept saying to Jerry, is this what Mr. Koch wants? Like, Mr. Koch has anything to do with, you know, what the content was. But, you know, he came in three times. The first two times to read for Stryker, and the third time to read for Elaine. So we didn't realize at the time there might be other stuff happening. So, yeah.
We should have known back then.
Yeah, we didn't know, yeah.
When what was the weekend like when you didn't know if they would let you direct the movie? And basically, you got another offer from another studio.
Yeah, we had another offer from Avco Embassy at the time. I don't know if they're still in existence, but they were going to let us direct. So we took a weekend to figure out where we're going to go, and we decided, yes, we're going to go with Avco Embassy. Just another stupid decision that we were saved. So we told Jeff Katzenberg, who was then the vice president there, we said, well, we've decided to go with Avco. We're not going to go stay at Paramount. And it took him about 5 minutes to convince us that we were not going to Avco and we're going to stay at Paramount. But I think that may have kind of lit a fire under someone, and they said, we better give in. So they did let us direct.
So you had a 2 week hanging sword over your heads to direct the movie. They could have fired you within the first 2 weeks. What was the first scene you filmed for Airplane?
Well, very wisely, our producer, John Davison, scheduled for the first day's dailies, first day's shooting, Shirley, You Can't Be Serious. And then I am serious and don't call me Shirley. So that was right on the first days. And evidently, they told us the screening room, just everybody, it erupted. They cracked up. And then Katzenberg called minutes later saying, don't worry about being fired.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah.
So interesting. You think about the choices you make when you're scheduling a movie. You're basing it on location, budget, actors' schedules, things like that. And to shoot that scene first, and that ensures you don't get fired as a director, is a stroke
of
brilliance.
You know, I remain surprised that they were surprised at that because, you know, we knew it would work. And then yet when it did, you know, Leslie Nielsen being funny and saying it completely straight, then they got it because evidently from the script, they didn't really get it 100%.
I wonder if people, you know, when you see the words on the page, the jokes don't really translate, and you don't necessarily understand that what makes Airplane brilliant and what makes your style of comedy brilliant is playing. The actors don't realize they're in a comedy.
Right. Well, we said to the actors, don't play it straight. Play it like you don't know that you're in a comedy. And that's really the only way we can do it. And everybody understood it. Lloyd Bridges was a little slow to understand it. He was trying to make sense out of his dialogue. And he just, you know, in his defense, you know, actors want to find a character. And he was trying to find a character, and we just wanted him to play Lloyd Bridges.
Yeah.
We didn't know anything about character.
What was the most difficult day shooting Airplane?
Well, probably Kareem.
because he wouldn't fit in the cockpit, or?
No, it was because he's a non-actor, and there's a child actor, and also Peter Graves with the kid was, you know, that had to be dialed in exactly. You know, it had to be. Have you ever seen a grown man naked? He couldn't look at the kid. I mean, it had to be done a certain way.
To make it more menacing? Is that why?
There's a fine... That was a tightrope. That was a fine line we had to
tread.
Yeah,
I mean, not making eye contact is a stroke of brilliance, right? He's flying a plane, of course.
Yeah. But it wasn't perverse. We were making fun of the image of pilots.
Yes. So the movie comes out and is a smash hit. At what point did you realize, holy shit, we've got a hit on our hands here?
Well, actually, we realized it before opening night. We had a first screening just for the executives at Paramount, and that was a disaster, like every first screening of a comedy is.
Why?
Because you don't know what's funny, and you generally edit together about 110 minutes, and the movie actually has to be cut down to 85 minutes. But you just don't know what is funny. So we always take it out to get previewed. And in those days, we would take it to colleges. And then we trim the movie to the laughs.
Wow.
But we didn't know. So we didn't know in that screening, and we just had to kind of endure that. And then we got to work in the cutting room, and then we screened it at the University of California, Davis, which is, I guess, near Sacramento. And that worked great. So I think we knew we had it. Right there.
Really? Yeah. When that first test screening, does anyone else wish they could have been there for that, right? Wouldn't that be wild? How did you feel afterward? Did it get the laughs you expected in the room?
You mean the first?
The first one. Like,
it was terrible. We thought, oh, my God, we've been working 10 years since the theater, and this is going to be a flop. This didn't work. But there was one guy in the audience who laughed all the way through, and we cut the movie to him.
Really?
To one guy. It ended up working. And also, Katzenberg was great in, talking us off the ledge.
Yeah.
Because we tended to be very, on the edge.
Yeah. When you make Airplane, it comes out, it's a smash hit. I did the inflation calculator, by the way. It made $450 million in today's dollars. And
yeah,
the budget
and
was
and
$3.5
million.
The
budget was $3.2 million. So
crazy.
And the studio couldn't hide the money fast enough. So we did see a little bit of profit. Yes.
I mean, that is a massive.
Because we had the
hit.
Worst deal in ever. Because they just. Yeah.
When did you realize the legacy of what you had created? Years go by. You know, we think about that a lot with Impractical Jokers.
Or you guys have no legacy, but
we
Airplane
have
is we really none. Have a.
I have
legacy.
No pride either at this point.
Right. Yeah, but we do get asked. You know, did you were you surprised when it became a hit? And the truthful answer is no, we were not surprised because we had been telling people for 5 years, finance this movie, it's going to be a big hit. So when it was, we thought, okay, this is what it should have been. However, we were surprised at the fact that it's lasted this long.
Yeah.
And we still show it in front of live audiences, and it still gets the same laughs. Same thing with Top Secret.
Top Secret has become a classic over the years, right?
And that gets the same laughs.
I love all your movies. Top Secret is my favorite one. And in Zucker's office, where the first time you invite us to your home, right? We go in, and in his office, he's got the anal intruder.
The giant fist that vibrates.
It's two feet wide. It's mounted on the wall.
And we have the big phone in there. Yeah.
I've got the same thing in my house, but it's not from a movie.
Well, you've never invited me to your house.
You're welcome. You want to come over tonight?
Sure.
No. Shit.
I can't. Yeah.
So it's amazing the legacy over the years from Airplane and, of course, from you have to mention Naked Gun. Those were my favorite. And one of the things, I'm in the audiobook for this, and I'm in the physical book as well. And the guys and I, I've told the story many times, but your movies were so impactful on the guys and I from Jokers. And for me personally, because you know, my father passed away a few months ago from Alzheimer's, a disease he had struggled with for many years. And as a family, we struggled with for many years. And you know, in the past 2 years, he didn't recognize me anymore. Certainly didn't recognize my mother before she passed. And to the day he died, he could still quote Airplane. Crazy,
that's
right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. He thought I was Shirley.
Shirley, yeah. That's good.
Like, I think that's a testament to what you created, bringing generations. It was the movie my father and I bonded over.
You know, our movies do not divide generations. I mean, yeah. I think everybody can. We used to say, like about some of the Naked Guns, actually, you know, a movie the whole family can see, just not together. Because some of the things are a little rude. But I think, you know, we're not making fun of, like, the older generation, and we're not. You know, it's just like it does go around that.
I do want to take time for some Q&A. Before we do, one question I've always meant to ask you, and I thought this would be kind of interesting, is out of all the eras of your life, from your early days making that student film in college to opening the Kentucky Fried Theater in Wisconsin, then to L.A., then to the making of Airplane, then Naked Gun, so on and so forth, Top Secret, if there were any era you could go back to in your life to relive for the first time again, what would it be and why?
Well, during my lifetime, because I always wanted to go back
to
1941 see if I could be around when my parents met. But I think that I would go back to, I would love to do Top Secret over again.
Really?
Yeah. And put in a character for Val. But, you know, there's always stuff that you'd want to do over again. But for me, it's always, I'm always looking forward to the next thing, and I have a new script that I'm going to do in the spring.
How cool is that? Zucker's written a new movie. They start shooting,
and it's a film noir. And finally, I'm going to get a chance to do it—a black and white movie.
Yeah, can we announce it now? He cast me as a lead. How cool!
Yeah,
it wasn't the lead.
It was of the janitor. I think. Yes.
The janitor.
Yeah. No, janitor number three. No,
not the janitor in the movie, the janitor on set. I'll be cleaning up after. Okay, I want to make sure we have some time for Q&A. So anything burning you'd like to ask Mr. Zucker, they'll bring mics around to you.
Thanks for having us tonight. It's been really funny so far.
Go disastrously wrong.
Yeah, before your question, yeah.
I would say some of your movies got us through COVID. We brought our kids here tonight. Naked Gun is definitely our favorite. What was it like working with Leslie Nielsen on multiple movies? Naked Gun, Airplane, Scary Movie.
Leslie was great. He was a funny guy. Although, I mean, all of the funny lines were written by Pat Proft, but Leslie on the set he was an anarchist, and he would bring this little diaphragm which made fart sounds. And while the other actor was trying to be serious and read the lines, Leslie would go, you know, like that. And he would do that on talk shows. We did a press tour together, and we were in Charlotte, North Carolina, and on a crowded elevator, and people recognized him as old Mr. Nielsen, and he would do the fart machine. And people couldn't get off that elevator fast enough. But no, he was a great guy. And so I think I put the eulogy that I read at his wake is in the book.
Hi. I just have a question. Growing up, Mr. Zucker.
You can call me David.
David. Growing up, David.
I thought you were going to say you could call me Mr. Zucker.
She just did.
Yeah. Were you inspired by anyone in your family? Was your family, you know, was there always jokes going on? Like, where did you inspire your humor?
Actually, we were inspired by my dad. He didn't know how to tell a joke, but he would say very funny things with a straight face and then let people laugh. I mean, he would kid around with his... He had a real estate firm, and he had, you know, an assistant and some other employees, and he would always tease them and just... But say everything in very straight face. And so I think we were inspired by that. Also, at the dinner table at our house growing up, it was a pun fest. We would just be doing puns all dinner time.
David, I just want to thank you for all the
humor. You should call me Mr. Zucker.
Oh, sorry.
Don't disrespect David Zucker.
So, Mr. David Zucker.
Yes.
But once again, wanted to thank you. Your Airplane was the first movie I ever paid to go see twice, ever. Paper route money, as a matter of fact.
Which movie was that?
Airplane.
Oh, Airplane.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. We should have talked about that.
Yeah, a little bit. My paper route? No, okay. Anyway, I remember watching cable one day, and a movie popped on called Kentucky Fried Movie, and I had never seen anything like this in my life. And you guys didn't talk about that at all. I'm curious how that evolved. And
well, it evolved because we wrote the first draft of Airplane, and we couldn't get it financed, so John Landis came to see our show and said, why don't you do a movie of your show? And so that's, you know, we wrote a script based on sketches from our theater show and a lot of new material, and that's how we did it. And we didn't know how to direct, so John Landis directed it.
Obviously, you couldn't make a movie like that today. Well, do you have any statement about, like, you know, if that's a good thing, a bad thing, or anything like that?
If you made a movie like that, I mean, it'd have to be R-rated. But I do get asked a lot, you know, could you make Airplane today? And my answer is always, of course, just without the jokes. and so that's what, you know, that's, but it, you know, there's a lot of sensitivity today, not among the audience, but in the studio boardrooms. The studio executives is a frightened class of people, and they probably would have said, you know, the pilot trying to come on to a little boy, no, we couldn't do that, or subtitling black people, you can't do that. I mean, it's just too sensitive today, but I'm still going to do... I'm going to do my next movie, and I'm going to continue to be insensitive. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
What was the riskiest project you've worked on, either in the context of finance or content?
Well, I did a goodness video once, and I cast people who I knew, celebrities that I knew, and it was going to be shown on PBS, and it's the importance of being good and honest, and I cast O.J. Simpson. So only I could have done this, and so unfortunately it was not shown. I think we showed it on PBS, but we cut out O.J.
What was your last interaction with O.J.?
Oh, you know, I really don't want to talk about it that much, but it was at the rap party of Naked Gun 33 and a third. I just said goodbye to him. I shook his hand. I sold him my knife collection, and I never saw him. I never saw him again after that. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Checks out.
Yeah. I just want to say thank you for this. And the first movie I ever bought was Airplane on VHS, and they weren't cheap then. But if you ever want to remake the movie, I already have an airline pilot's uniform, and my hair's the right color. And you need a blind pilot.
Yeah, I think we did have a joke with the three blind pilots, with Jose Feliciano and Ray Charles.
Stevie Wonder.
Then Stevie Wonder, right.
Thank you.
That was the question.
Great.
But we did. But Paramount wanted to do a sequel to Airplane, and we didn't, because we didn't think we had enough jokes in, you know, for the second half of Airplane. But they were insistent. They wanted to do Airplane 2. So we came up with an idea. And the idea was, you know, Bob Hayes and Julie Haggerty, you know, they fly down the plane, and they're going to get married. He takes her home to meet the family, and it's the Godfather. And so, and we would do the whole thing, and it would be, you know, the marionette thing with the twisted plane. But and the studio loved the idea, but then they had to run it by Francis Coppola, and he said no, because he wanted to do Godfather 3. So wow. I mean, what we say in the book is that, you know, everybody would have been better off had we done Airplane 2.
Let's take a question from over here.
Going back to what you said about if you made something like this today, it would have to be R-rated. Now, going back to, you know, the Airplane and the Naked Guns, surprising thing is they are all PG or PG-13, and you still slipped in some, like, amazing stuff in there, like the nice beaver line. Were there any times that you actually did butt heads with the MPAA over any kind of gags?
Yeah, there was always... There are some movies that we did. There was a couple of movies. There was a movie called High School High, and that was a big fight with the MPAA over that, and that was PG-13. And then I did Basketball with Matt Stone and Trey Parker, and we just decided we'll just do it R-rated. So I kind of, if I had that to do over again, there's an answer to your question. I could do Basketball over with PG-13.
Mm. I meant to relive from a joy point of view. Where would you, what era of your life would you relive?
Probably when I got married, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And it was a wonderful moment. And probably, a low point was then when I got divorced. So what can you do? Yeah.
What was it about Zero Hour that made you think it would be so funny as a comedy movie?
Oh, well, you know what we would do is we would watch these old movies. And really, these black and white thrillers, you know, just dead serious. They had no sense. There was not a joke in the whole thing. And we used to redub them. And so if a character would say, it's a war movie or something, what time does the plane leave? And the other characters, at exactly 0800 hours. And we would dub in, where is your hand? It's right here at the end of my wrist. So... You know, and we would do, and so this Zero Hour seemed like the perfect movie to redub. But then it was just a short leap to saying, let's just recast it and remake it. So that was the big idea that we had.
Is there a scene from Airplane that ended up on the cutting room floor that you wish had ended up in the movie that all of us got to see?
No, usually they end up on the cutting room floor because we preview it and it doesn't get a laugh. I mean, there was a... We had in the airport, walking through the airport, is this gorgeous model woman, and she just goes and just spits against the wall, and we thought it was hysterical. I think unfortunately they don't save any of the old dailies, so I'd like to see that again and see what we did wrong. But it must have been something that we didn't do right. But your question brings up, you know, when they. On comedies, when they say, and there's deleted scenes, an extra thing, you know, deleted scenes in comedies are deleted because they aren't funny. So why would anybody want to sit through unfunny scenes? I don't know.
Have you ever seen the inside of a Turkish prison?
You've been waiting years to ask that question.
I think, you know, the year before Midnight Express had just been released, and that was... And we were impressed with the Turkish prisons.
Was that your only question? I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Your one opportunity to speak to David Zucker, and that's your question.
To know if I was in a Turkish prison.
I appreciate the question, though. Yeah, go ahead.
Thinking about Police Squad, and what was the difference? What was it like directing a TV show versus a movie? And why did it only last 6 episodes? Was it supposed to last more?
Well, it was... You know, we really wanted to do Naked Gun, but we didn't know how to do a story and a plot at that point. So Michael Eisner said, I can get ABC to put 6 episodes of this half hours on the air. So we said yes, and we wrote and directed the pilot. But with TV, it's just, you know, you don't have the time, you know, you have to write it in a week and then shoot it in a week. There's not enough time that you have in a feature to, we wrote Airplane for years, just, you know, rewriting, and then we had the time to direct it. And then the TV show, you know, these things really don't work on TV because it's our material's supposed to be seen by a theatrical audience so you can hear the laughs. Otherwise, it needs a laugh track, and Tony Thomopoulos, the head of ABC, kind of asked us if we would put a laugh track on it. And, you know, we felt bad for him because it was, you know, the thing was not getting very good ratings. But we said, well, we couldn't because it's not supposed to be funny. And so there was a big press conference where a bunch of reporters were asking him, why did you, and they obviously liked Police Squad, and they were really grilling him. And Tony Thomopoulos said, Police Squad didn't work because you had to watch it. And that was, I guess that's true, yeah. So people, a lot of TV people it's not so much sight gags. It's, the Jokers can do it, and Seinfeld does it, and Larry David. I mean, there's certain shows that are great and made for TV. I don't like most sitcoms. I don't find them funny at all. And even most movies, I don't really find that funny, but I want to, you know, I remember there was a movie called Bad Grandpa, and I thought I was really laughing at that.
Yeah.
I just remember the movies that I like, and Bill Hader was in Trainwreck. I thought that was funny,
yep.
And yeah, anyways.
Mr. Zucker, David, well, is it okay if I just call you Shirley? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good, or Turkish prison, I don't know. Yeah.
So I thought it was really interesting hearing about your start with short films, comedic, in school, and I was wondering if you had any, you know, specific advice to give to someone else in that position who wants to start in making films and comedy and things like that at a young age.
Oh, yeah. Quit now. You'll never make it. That's and okay. I don't mean to be too flip about it, but, you know, if you can disregard that advice, you'll be halfway there. And that is to say that I don't really want to be responsible for saying to anyone, "Hey, you can do it." You know, go it. You know, because it is tough, and I think we show in the book how it was tough, but a lot of it took a lot of perseverance. You know, and we just kept at it, and we always believed in ourselves. And the other thing we had was we had the three of us. We really had each other, and that was a big part of it. So, but I thought it was a partially real self-confidence and naivete that got us, you know, that made us think that we could do this. We could go to L.A. and do movies, and we just thought there was no reason why we couldn't. Yeah,
which is one of the main reasons I love you dearly as a friend and respect most about you is that, and you really get a sense of this in the book when you're reading it, that Zucker just wouldn't take no for an answer. He never once believed, out of the three of you, that's right. Most definitely your personality, and knowing you now for years as a friend, just never thought to himself, well, why can't we do this? You know, it never occurred to him that he couldn't succeed doing what he loved.
Yeah, I mean, we would watch movies, and we liked Mel Brooks, you know, Blazing Saddles. We liked Woody Allen, Bananas and stuff, but we thought we could do that. We could do as well as that, so we kept at it.
And thank God they did, right? I think we have to wrap up now, but my friend, one of the greatest, people ask us a lot, like, what is, what's your best experience from Impractical Jokers? What do you love most? What's the, you know? And one of the greatest moments in my life is meeting you and becoming friends with you. And I never in my life imagined we would become friends or that you would like our work. It blew us away. The book is amazing. You're going to love it when you read it. When you go out for autographs with David, he can also give financial advice, whatever you need to know.
And thank you. And, you know, for what you guys have done for me is, you know, I don't like anything. And so people would think, well, he's just old and doesn't have a sense of humor. But I said, okay, I like the Jokers. So that kind of gets me.
The legacy of your book and your career extends long past all of our lives. How about a hand for creating such an amazing movie?
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Love you, my friend. Yeah. Thank you.
Love you, too. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.